the cloud. Okay, so welcome to everybody listening now and in the future. My name is Kate White, and I'm here with Michael Trout tonight. He's our keynote, our starting out, our first lecture of the prenatal and perinatal professional lecture series that's part of my online schoolroom that supports pre and perinatal healing. And for those of you who don't know me, I'm a somatic therapist. I work with babies. I work with adults that have early trauma. I'm pioneering how to create training programs for a variety of professionals. And I have a bunch of students, some of whom are online tonight, who are part of my first training cohort. And tonight I have asked Michael Trout to give us a lecture. Michael, I met years ago when I started studying with Myrna Martin, and he wrote a paper called Searching for Aunt Rosie that changed my life forever. And I never ever forgot about Michael. I met him also in 2004 at the APA Congress, where he and I have done many things at APA, and we'll be going together to Australia this year to do the World Association for Infant Mental Health. And he has been so active in so many people's lives, helping them understand babies, the mother-baby dyad, the importance of care for mothers and babies and families that have babies. He's pioneered a whole lot of work, documentaries from the baby's perspective, books, training programs. He's supported the prenatal bonding in this country and has made a huge difference in the lives of professionals around the world. I know he's retired now, but he did put in a good, what, 45 years or so, Michael? How many years? And he still delights in giving his work in these kinds of venues. I have to say his books are profound. I read See Me as a Person for the first time this year and really asked him if he would talk about those beautiful skills he talks in there about in there, wondering, following, and holding. And tonight he'll be talking about the mindset on and everyday practice with children and adults. So please welcome Michael Trout.
Thanks. Some of you are shy about putting your picture up. We'd love to see you. From my perspective, there are just a lot of black boxes and maybe a dozen photos. So let yourself be seen. Ah, that's lovely. Thank you. So the point of tonight, from my perspective, as I understood my assignment, was to consider together with you what matters in clinical practice with young children and their families, particularly because it turns out that it's also the very same stuff that matters when a doctor walks into a hospital room or when a occupational therapist walks in with a fretful mother and a baby with a disability. It all turns out to be almost the same. And that was a bit of a surprise to me when I really put myself to thinking in a clear way about what mattered the most in my practice. As some of you know, I retired a few years ago, and I can tell you that I was brilliant. And not a one of my patients took note of that fact as they departed my practice at the end. Many wanted to give me feedback, and none said, "Oh my God, you have the mind of the most amazing person, and your insights just lifted me up, and your brilliant strategies helped my children." Nobody said that to me. What they said to me instead was something very short and usually very soft, like, "You were there. You sat with me." One patient brought something she'd had her sister, who lives in China, make out of Chinese characters that just says, "You listened." And she presented that as a kind of a piece of art to me. And that got me to thinking, particularly because my wife, with whom I go on lots of walks and with whom I have lots of conversations, has been interested for many years on improving healthcare, medical healthcare, physical healthcare, in ways related less to technology and more to empathy. And so she asked me one time on a walk, if I could summarize the things that mattered the most. What did I think mattered the most in my relationships with and work with individuals and families, just in case there might be some carryover, something that doctors and nurses could learn about how to better relate to their patients. And out of that came this winnowing down of a huge amount of research and a great deal of experience into these key words that we're going to consider tonight. The first of them being simply presence. So we're going to wonder tonight about what presence means and what it is and what it makes possible that without it is not possible. For example, attunement. I think almost anybody, any of us on this screen would say that attunement to our patients is critical, but I'm not sure we know exactly always how to do it. Or when we have, we may know when we haven't, when the baby doesn't get better, or when the mom who really our patient leaves. We know when we haven't, we don't always know when we have and how to get there. Unless we do know. And that's my question really to you. I'm not gonna ask you for feedback right this minute, but I am in a few minutes. So I want you to be thinking about this. What do you really know about attunement from your own personal experience? That is to say, can you think of somebody who was absolutely present for you at one point in your life or throughout a good deal of your life? Someone who attuned to you and you felt it. And I want you to try to feel that right now. And in a few minutes, maybe tell us about it. Who was present for you? Who was attuned to you? And then we're going to consider the behaviors that arise out of presence and attunement that are described in depth in the book Kate mentioned, which are wondering, a most profound activity that most people don't think of as an activity, but I believe is absolutely central to us, to our success, which is that we simply shut up, watch, wonder with an absolutely clear deck, by which I mean an open mind. And we keep wondering, even when others try to dissuade us from wondering by, for example, insisting that we give a diagnosis or that we give at the very least a bunch of fancy sounding words that will describe what's really wrong with the child or what's really wrong with the parent. If we still resist that and keep wondering, even in the face of such pressure to diagnose, what happens? Second verb is following. It's that thing we do naturally, I believe, when we've begun to engage in wonder, which is to say we make an agreement. A tacit agreement with the family that we will watch, we will wonder, and we will learn by following. Following is what we do on the trail of the data as we watch the baby's behavior, as we watch the interactions between the child and the mother or father or grandmother that may be in the room, as we watch what happens between the two partners in a couple. Following is that thing we do as we desperately seek data by watching what people do. And we remember every little teeny bit of it. The third verb, then is holding, which I consider to be the most mystical, or at least magical, of them all. It is that thing we do that communicates to the patient, I am present, I am watching, I'm wondering, I'm not deciding, I'm following you, and because of all that, I hold you. I'm going to remember not only what you tell me, but what you all did together that day out at your house when I came to see you. I'm going to remember all of it and hold it and what I saw and what I think and what I imagine. I'm going to hold it all together in perpetuity so that 10 weeks from now, I'll be able to bring it up again. I'll be able to say to the little girl who has proclaimed loudly to me that her damned adoption doesn't mean a thing, she says, trying to get me off the topic of her adoption years ago. It will mean that 10 weeks later, I get to bring up to her, oh yeah, that's right. You mentioned one time that you like those kind of pants that you're wearing today, and that you think maybe your mom had pants like that. And I said, which mom do you mean? And you got real mad at me. I remember that. That's holding. So I thought it might be a good idea to get quickly into a case. I'll keep it very brief. I picked it out of the blue because there it could have been any case. But this one kind of intrigued me, as did many that are described in my book. And it is a case in which the parents wanted me to just come to their house, not do any of that stuff I just described to you that I was going to do. They didn't know I would do all that stuff. They just wanted me to come to their house, look at their kid, who they thought was probably blind, or if not blind, certainly disabled in some other way that was preventing him from making eye contact with them, ever, they said. They wanted me to come, look, diagnose, tell, and then maybe if I have an idea about where they could go for treatment, that would be great. Oh boy, did they call the wrong guy. Because what I did when I came to their house is what I've just described to you. I think it is incumbent upon us always to do. And that involves a lot of quiet, being very quiet and watching and wondering about everything you see, following and seeing what comes up. And so what I saw was this. First of all, by the way, I got to tell you that I walked into that house a little bit shaken by what I might see, knowing that blindness in an infant is felt to be catastrophic to parents. Would I be the one to deliver that news? Would I discover something else that was as bad or worse, some terrible disability? And then later I shuddered at all the ways I could have really seriously messed up if I had spent too much time looking for that diagnosis instead of just looking at their little boy and looking and listening to them. So they were well-educated, thoughtful. In fact, both were professors. And they mentioned early on that they'd had a lot of infertility before adopting this child. So this is the first I learned that he was adopted. They said everything about him and everything with him had been wonderful, except for the very unsettling fact that it appeared he could not see, or at least he could not look, because he did not look at them. He did not make eye contact with them. And he was by now, about 8 months. So they'd have a lot of experience with him. They were also very well prepared for this child. They'd wanted a child terribly and had quite a lot of infertility treatments before making the decision to adopt. But mom said quickly, in spite of how well prepared they were and how much they were looking forward to him, she had to admit that she didn't have what she imagined to be the right feelings about him. She said she didn't feel close to him. I don't know exactly, this is a quote, I don't know exactly what the right feelings are, but I'm pretty sure I don't have them. Sometimes I just can't make a connection with him. So that was the opening volley in the first 10 minutes of data collection. They then went into detail about their adoption of this child. And in the process happened to mention that he wasn't actually their first experience with adoption. There had been another child they meant to adopt before Adam. And they, in response to my questions about that, went into detail about the adolescent teen, the adolescent mom that they had met and agreed to adopt her child, and they followed her through the pregnancy, and dad grumbled about how much money he had given her for her medical bills and so on. He thought that was the most important thing. They named him together, and they painted that name, which I'll use as a substitute, John Stanley. They painted that name in the nursery planned for this child in a big rainbow going across the wall. Dad put a lot of effort, he said, into creating that name on the wall. The doctor had set a date for induction of this adolescent mom, so they all knew when it was going to happen, and it was planned that they would all be there. However, mom skipped town, and nobody seemed to know where she was. The caseworker finally found her and hooked her up by phone with these to-be adoptive parents. And on the call, she acknowledged that the baby had been born, that she had changed her mind, and she was going to keep the child. Dad said he had no reaction to that at all, but mom and dad decided to go away for the weekend and just be quiet and alone together after this happened. Mom said she had tremendous sorrow, but she couldn't imagine why. She would say things like, it wasn't my baby. It wasn't like he was really mine. It's not like I actually lost him. I never even saw him. So why do I feel so sorrowful? Like I'm missing something. So the caseworker called them back and said, say, I think I've got a fix for this. I got you another baby. Isn't that great? Dad didn't have a reaction to that at all. Mom thought it sounded a little weird to put another baby right in the place where the baby she mysteriously was having sorrowful feelings about had been and had disappeared. But they said, okay, and that's where Adam came from. And Adam would become the child that mom didn't have the right feelings for, and Adam would become the child that wouldn't look at them. So they had prepared lunch. That doesn't happen very often when I'm on a home visit. And as we were sitting at the table, I began to turn my attention toward the original complaint that he made no eye contact, and was surprised to notice that he actually made lots of it. The biggest mistake we can make is to turn on our parents, to argue with them about the realities that are theirs, to argue with them about their observations. So there was no discussion about how this child actually saw very well and was making lots of eye contact. It was just a piece of information I tucked away. A child described to have made no eye contact in 8 months of life actually made a lot of it. But there was one additional little piece to that observation about his eye contact. It was that when he was being transferred from one lap to another, he would, upon coming toward the receiving person, he would turn his head distinctly to the side, 90 degrees. And that is actually what they were reporting on. It was that eye contact that was missing. The eye contact at the moment of transition from one parent to another. And then I would learn it was bigger than that, because they wanted to prove to me that they were right about this eye contact thing. They handed him to me so that I could see that he won't look at anybody. As he came to me, he looked directly into my face, but when he got about 3 feet away, he turned his head distinctly aside 90 degrees and avoided eye contact with me. The data are accumulating. I hope you're having that feeling in your scientific body now. So he's not the first child. He's a child mother feels like she doesn't have the right feelings about. And he's a child who, during transitions, turns his head distinctly to the side. And then the final piece of data that helped me to put it all together. As mom was finishing the story about the other baby and this sorrow that she didn't think she had any right to have, she said, and I quote, about Adam, "I'm afraid he will look at me and will see that I'm thinking about John Stanley." So she has a hand in this eye contact avoidance. She doesn't want her little boy to look at her and see in her eyes, see in her face, that she's actually thinking about the other boy that she didn't get. So we began to ponder together. I described what I had been seeing, and we began to wonder together what such avoidance of eye contact at moments of transition might be about. And it didn't take a rocket scientist, and there were lots of us in this room, lots of rocket scientists, I mean. It didn't take someone of our caliber to figure this part out. What had transitions meant for this baby? He had left his first mother, and when he looked back, was she gone? Babies get used to comings and goings of objects and people and faces because they come and they go. But what if they go and they don't come? What if they just go? And the next time you look, they're gone again. And what if that happened again in the foster home, where he was only for a very short time, about a week or 10 days, but may have made some kind of relationship with that mom, and when he looked around again, she was gone. And then he has these new people, these adoptive parents. And I began to wonder out loud with them whether he was preserving himself, defending himself, saving himself by not looking at the people he was afraid he might lose. And to my very great surprise, mother said, "Oh my gosh, all three of us, that is mother, father, and baby Adam, have something in common, don't we? We're all grieving losses." Dad, by the way, was not convinced and brought up the money deal again. So it's not like everyone in the room was jumping up and down with insight, but it was a pretty remarkable moment. What Dad did say toward the end of the session, as we were standing, getting ready for me to leave, was, "Did I know any place to get better paint?" It's one of those questions that just sort of resonates in the atmosphere, and you know you're not supposed to answer it, but you know it's a meaningful question. Turns out what he meant was that paint he got from Menards sure wasn't very good, because he'd been up in the nursery ever since John Stanley got born, ever since Adam came to them, and he'd been trying to paint over that rainbow and that name John Stanley that he had originally put in it during the pregnancy before. And it worked, and then as soon as it dried, John Stanley's name would reappear. I thought it was a profound metaphor, and I actually think Dad was trying to tell me, yeah, I'm a chemist, I don't do feelings. But boy, I sure can tell you about how I can't get that other kid out of our nursery, the one that was that came, was supposed to come before. Now, none of this means a lot. I tried to give you examples there of presence and wondering and following, and then the holding that was necessary as the evidence of grief came out. But none of it means anything unless it's good science. And that can only be seen in the outcome. And I didn't know the outcome for a couple of weeks when mom called and said, I don't know that we need you anymore. I asked what she meant, and she said, well, he's doing fine. I said, do you mean his vision seems fine? She said, oh, he never had a vision problem. And I said, well, do you mean the eye contact thing? And she said, yeah, he looks at everybody all the time. I said, you mean that thing that you asked me to come to your house for disappeared? Yeah, she said, I don't know what happened. It just never come back. So that was an easy case. We just got to use these activities that I've described, and they bore fruit. And we had intelligent, well-intentioned parents who came out with history quickly, and we were able to put things together. It doesn't always work that beautifully, but I hope that makes a little clearer why they're so critical. What we easily could have done is act like a physician, act like so many providers, march in with our intelligence and our scientific background, and begin throwing diagnoses around, failing to ask questions, failing to make much out of the data that do emerge, like the fine tuning of what it meant for him to look or not look at people, and the story of mom's strange sorrow, which wasn't, of course, strange at all. We could have walked all over these pieces of these people, and maybe we would have come up with a diagnosis that we could convince somebody of, or maybe we just suggest a whole bunch of vision exams or developmental disability exams and run them through the ringer unnecessarily. And worse yet, maybe someone along the way would think they found something and would be off to the races treating a disorder that wasn't even there and not treating the disorder that was there. Okay. So it's time for you to follow up with your little part. Could just a few of you say what came to your mind a few minutes ago when I asked you to think of someone that was once, or maybe more than once, really present with you, seriously attuned to you?
Okay. Just put your hand up and, or write in the chat. There's a lot of you. I'm happy to open up someone's microphone. But I can't see you all on my picture frame. So if Anne, okay. Go ahead.
It's just a feeling that I get that like their breathing's not held and you don't feel like they're trying to move away. And it's just soft and no words filling the spaces. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just being there. So that's how I feel that with someone else who's with me.
And who is this someone else that came into your mind?
My very well-trained husband.
Well, you don't think he came by this naturally?
No.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you, Anne. Anyone else would like to share? Like I don't know. If you want to click on your hand raise, I'll see if there's anyone I can see. Because I can.
Oh, Rita had her hand up.
Which one?
Rita, just below you.
Rita. Vita?
I was really lucky to have been involved in different healing studies, and to be able to practice presence. And it's really interesting because I went to a healing school where I experienced that for the first time, and I realized that that's really, in some ways, a bottom line for people to realize that what they're going through is not necessarily pathologic, but it's what's happening. It's a normal response to the circumstances that they're happening in this moment. And I just really appreciate that. And I teach that now in my workshops, where people, you know, because so many people, myself included, go through these things of in moments of stress, thinking that something must be wrong with them, that they're feeling this way. And what I like to do is validate to people that what they're experiencing is normal in this moment in time, considering their situation. So I'm really lucky that I've had that kind of teaching, and I teach that myself.
Thank you, Rita.
Yeah.
By the way, several of the chat notes are very much worthy of attention. One person says an example of this might be what it is in the room when you are nursing your baby to sleep in the dark. Another person says, it's you, Kate. It's you that have done that for her.
Thank you, Joanne. And then Adrian Adams says, but I think of a friend who's able to listen, ask questions with me in a wondering way, and not to try to make decisions for me, but to be present. I think this experience is what we strive towards within my work, but there is a lot of growth to be had. I think that I've had some profound experiences with presence, and I had a practitioner once be so present and so curious about my experience that I ended up having this big spiritual opening. So it was that quality of being there with a light touch and curiosity, but without coming too close and trying to fix it, but just being curious and asking questions in that wondering way, and allowing me to discover what my experience was. That was my experience with this presence.
That's the demon, isn't it? The desire to fix it.
Yes, that's what kills it. Or another thing I find that really hurts it is if they think they know. They come in with their knowing and not helping me with my knowing.
An awareness on their part that they don't know, but they feel profoundly that they need to know, probably for very important personal reasons. And so they get very energetic and active about making sure you know all that they know.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I found from listening to you, Michael, and also for those of you who are out there, his new book, This Hallowed Ground, which is an audiobook that you can get through the Infant Mental Health Association of Michigan. I'll find it and put it in the notes, but story after story after story of wondering, holding, and wandering, and wandering, following, holding. And it's sort of, you have to build up that muscle of being with the story and not trying to do anything to it. And that's kind of what you do over and over again in every one of those stories. And I know that you say you make mistakes and you talk about your mistakes. That's one of the things I like about this book, that you talk about things that you've done. But I really, it's a real art form to hold and not try to do, which is what I hear you doing a lot, Michael, which is why I wanted you to talk tonight.
Just to be clear, by the way, this person that I'm trying to get you to think about, who was present for you, attuned for you, does not have to be a person who was played an active or a healing role in your life. Maybe they just, as my grandmother would do when I was a very little boy, even a preschooler, just sit at the kitchen table with me in the dark with her Bible open and a half a cup of coffee with mostly cream in it in front of me and her cup of coffee in front of her. And we just sat there. That was it. That was enormously healing to me, but there were no words. There was no action beyond the action of simply being with. So if that expands what's going through your mind right now, as you search for an example, please.
Well, Tef Nichols wants to tell us a story, and I can't find you in all the many people that are out there. So just unmute yourself and tell us your story.
I can see you.
I guess I was thinking of sort of a similar familial relationship with my dad in particular, who I just remember from a very young age, maybe like 3 or 4, just taking me very seriously. And having, you know, I would have an idea or just like any sort of thought, and he would just engage with it in the way that you would engage with any kind of thought or conversation of somebody that you respect. And one in particular, I remember like thinking like big thoughts about like what happens if we are actually just small, like flies, the way that flies experience the world. And, you know, we would just like riff on these ideas together, but I'd be like 4 years old and just feel taken seriously in a way that made me feel really heard, in a way that rarely happens with kids that age, I think.
Do you have any idea from your knowledge of her why she didn't feel compelled to educate you?
So this is my dad.
Your dad, okay.
I think he was genuinely interested in what I was saying and thinking. And a lot of the things weren't necessarily, I guess you could have made teaching opportunities out of them. But he was also a pretty playful person. And so I think it was just more exciting to sort of get to see like he was interested in what was going on in my head. And that felt good.
You shrug your shoulders like that's not a very important statement, but it really seriously is for all of us.
Yeah.
He was actually interested. That kept his mouth shut. That kept him from using the opportunity to straighten you out about how the universe works and educate you. He was actually interested in what you had to say.
Yeah.
That could be a lesson for many of us. Who else?
Thank you. Well, there's people on the side here who say, I think of my mom when she listened to me. It was like every word I said mattered to her. That was from Kimberly Porter Hutton. Then Emily Bratcher said, it's the feeling of being felt and known, maybe even without having to explain myself, along with a sense of invitation to be together and share joy. Cheryl says, one story of feeling held in presence is of time with my grandmother, who I would sit close to as I held her arm. And Corey is, my maternal grandmother would just allow me to sit on her lap, even as a 9-year-old, and she would hum and sing in Slovak. Would you like another shared story, someone to speak,
yeah,
Michael?
I just want to make clear to everyone, however, why I ask you this question. It is not just to fill the time or to save my vocal cords. It is because in order to do these things that I'm talking about tonight, and most very importantly, in order to have confidence that doing these things is in fact doing something. Hope you're still with me with all that. In order for that to be the case, we have to remember what it was like for us when someone did it for us. That's one of the only things I think that will help us relax into imagining that being there, being present, wondering, is in fact doing something. And furthermore, it is the scientific thing to do. It is the thing most likely to get to the core of stuff. So I'm asking you to remember so that you can carry that memory with you. I really believe that part of why I could do what I did when I did it well, which wasn't all the time by any means, is really because my grandmother would come take up residence in the therapy room. I would just be my grandmother with somebody. So one last person like to speak to this?
Anybody want to share their story of having someone really be present with them? It would be good for all of us, you know. I don't see anybody. Type in the text because there's 4 pages of you. I'm happy to find you if I can. But you can also just open your microphone and tell us a story. Here goes Emily. I'm going to unmute. Go ahead.
Hi. I don't know if this quite fits into our discussion, but I recently, my husband recently asked me to buy a house with him, and I never wanted to buy a house in my life. And he, for years, this was a part of conflict between us. And finally got to the point where he was like, you got to figure out why you don't want to buy a house. And so I realized that I had a grandfather who had destroyed thousands of houses in the war in Russia for people. And I began to wonder about that and started to investigate my grandfather. And he died the year I was born. So he held me as a baby, but I never really met him as a person. And as I went and explored him, I found pictures on the internet from him and the war, and kept exploring. Finally, I found letters from him in the attic. And then I found a picture album of him, and I found books about his division and figured out where he was in the war and where he was after the war in the gulags in Russia and so forth. And so this went on for quite a few months. And the more I engaged with him in this internal dialogue about what his experience was like and why I had this feeling of not deserving to buy a house, the more I felt his presence, although, you know, obviously by that time he was dead by, I don't know, 40 years or so. And one morning I woke up and I thought, you know, maybe this is enough now. Maybe I can go for it now and buy a house. And somehow later that day, I realized that it was his birthday. And I didn't even know when his birthday was, but I looked him up on Wikipedia and found out there was his birthday. And the following week, we bought a house, and I've never looked back since. So I'm just curious about what you think, Michael, about this process of attunement across transgenerational trauma and transgenerational processes. I mean, I made it all up, but it was immensely meaningful to me.
You don't believe that. None of us in this room does tonight. And I bet your husband was thrilled to pieces.
He was happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Just one little example that pops into my mind, lest any of you are uneasy about the science part of this. Part of the reason I push so hard with the simplicity of these ideas is because I became convinced many decades ago that this was the way to avoid making terrible diagnostic errors and heading off into terribly unhelpful therapeutic directions. That the way to avoid those things was to back away, quiet down, and begin wondering. And a picture just popped into my mind, so I'll share it with you. It was the early 70s. We were sitting in the library at Freiburg's project in Ann Arbor, and we were watching old reel-to-reel videotapes, which is how in those days people like us got trained. And she was using one of the cases from her blind studies, Selma was. And the child was, by the way, the brilliant article, The Clinical Dimension of Baby Games, had not yet been written, but arose in part because of this case I'm about to describe to you. You should read that, by the way, if you haven't. It's brilliant and very apropos our discussion tonight. So the baby was, blind baby, was on the floor on his back, and the father was leaning over him, and at first just tickling him and playing with him lightly. But as the camera rolled, his behavior toward the child got more harsh and then more aggressive, and then he began to scream at him. And he began to pound on him on his genitals, which I'll bet you a half dozen of you at least out of the 200 will immediately understand the meaning of pounding on genitals of a blind baby by a father. He easily could have been turned in for child abuse at that moment. There could have been huge suspicions aroused about his adequacy as a parent, or maybe even his risk as a parent. Until you start thinking about what it might mean to be a dad whose son, firstborn son, cannot see. It means impotence to most fathers. And it means, therefore, the thing that father may well fear the most himself, not blindness, but powerlessness, impotence, lack of efficacy in the world. And he is now being overwhelmed with grief as he pounds on his boy's penis at what his boy will never experience. He'll never experience being a man. And the father's trying to wipe out his manliness. By wondering, by watching, and by holding, which was also done with this dad, we avoided terrible mistakes in clinical casework, terrible diagnostic mistakes, and we had an avenue open now toward intervention that we wouldn't have had we not done the wondering and watching and began to put together a picture of what it might mean. Anyone want to argue with me about that? Please, I invite it. Are we being too soft on the guy?
It is shocking to hear the story. It is. So I'm curious as to what you discovered with holding and wondering and following in this family.
Well, as often happens, of course, their defenses arise. It's not as if I can put my arm around this dad and say something comforting to him and he'll burst into tears and tell me of his fears. He was a profoundly defended guy. He was filled with rage, I think, at the impotence he'd experienced in his own life as a man, and terrified of what was going to happen to his boy, grief struck. And so all those layers of defense had to be worked with, but we had something to work with now. We didn't see him anymore as an abusive dad. We didn't see him anymore even as a dad without potential to form an attachment with his blind son, as he in fact did eventually. We saw a game that turned aggressive and we wondered about it. And that is what we then needed to continue to do in subsequent home visits. Please, someone argue with me or throw out another point of view about this baby game. I see Anne raising her hand there.
I get everything that you're saying. And the difficulty is holding that story and that empathy and compassion and all of that wondering with, are these people going to continue to employ your support to get to where they need to be? Because sometimes that doesn't happen. With what we're, I'm in Australia, so there's mandates to protect the child, and which involves the other agencies, which then take everything out of your hands and the parents' hands. So there's, I have been in that situation, not quite that, but what I perceive to be mistreatment of a child. And my offerings were misinterpreted, and they heard it really differently to what my intention was. So it's a really tricky one.
Indeed.
Because there's always something behind the something. But we are also obliged to protect the child.
And now it gets really complicated as we think how tricky it gets. Because in truth, the judge or the caseworker who dismisses what we've seen and wants to take more aggressive action and thinks we're just yodeling in the dark may well require, hold on to your hats, folks, a lot of empathy from us. Because in all likelihood, that caseworker or judge or other is also worried about self-efficacy. Is also worried about getting her name in the newspaper in the wrong place, is also angry at abusive dads, maybe. And so we then have to ask ourselves, not just how will I survive being attacked for my interpretations, but how will I look after the casework community around me, one in which I have to function, whether I like it or not? How will I survive with the judge or social workers or other officials who are themselves hurt and are going to take that out on families? So that's not an answer to the issue you bring up, Anne. Most of us, I suspect, on this call have been around that block you describe. We've taken a position and it's been cast aside, and we've seen the children suffer even. And I've blamed myself many times for having not spoken clearly, not been articulate enough, not made my case, or maybe I was just full of beans in the first place. Oh goodness, I just glanced at the clock, Kate.
Oh God.
We were planning to stop at 20 after and have a little meditation. I think maybe that's not the best use of our final 5 minutes. I wonder if we could do instead what we were also going to do after the meditation, which, by the way, you can listen to on your own now that I think of it. The book that Kate referred to earlier that brought her to invite me to do this tonight, See Me as a Person, has with it a meditation CD on which there are 12 meditations, audio only, made for nurses and physicians and other caregivers, therapists and so on. And what I was gonna play is on there. So listen to it on your own. But I wanna ask instead, I'm sorry, Kate, what?
I'll put it up in the in my classroom if people, you know, for people. I'll figure out a way of getting it to people.
So our last 5 minutes, I'd like to turn back to you again, because I'd really like to hear what you're taking away from tonight. Just a few words. What was most important to you? What resounded for you? What you didn't like? What you're taking away?
You can just open your microphone. Go ahead, Corey. I unmuted you. Go ahead.
Hey, Michael. You know, I always tell you that you've left me up on the mountain. I have lots of things I have to think about, but probably the best thing that happened tonight is thinking about that feeling of that one person who provided that presence with really not a lot of words at all. So I'm going to stay on that mountain for a while tonight and just think about that.
Good for you. And you'll have to decide if it's a safe place.
That yes. Yes.
Thank you, Corey.
Li Fang? I can't unmute you. Go ahead, unmute yourself.
Yes. Your presentation tonight just remind a sentence by Lao Tzu for me. He has a sentence saying that doing by not doing. I think I'm going to digest with it.
Wonderful.
Anybody else in the many of there 75 of you out there?
Hi, it's Rita. I just want to say that I think that in our society, being is underrated, and it's just so powerful, being rather than doing. And thank you for this seminar, Michael.
Being is underrated.
Yes.
Doing, therefore, must be overrated, eh?
Yes, and less is more.
Who else can tell us what you're taking away? Or what you didn't like, or what resounded in some other untoward or upsetting way for you?
Anybody? Just open your mic. I know there's a lot of you out there. People are starting to write in the chat. Wow, a lot of people. Thomas says, what I'm taking home is not diagnosis or fixing the problem, but we should probably be concerned about, but be there where the child, with the child and the family. Una says, I'm thinking about reflective supervision and the power of being with those who are being with others. Parallel process feels so strong.
What a wonderful application to the next level of supervision.
Yeah. And Heather says, my takeaway has to do with judgment and there being no good guys or bad guys, rather many people dealing with different issues. I have a hard time with babies as they can't fight back.
The question of, will we dawdle? Are we dawdling regarding the baby as we wonder and be quiet and be with? It's a terrifying thought. With an abusive or difficult family, will we dawdle and the baby will be hurt? I discuss in my last book, a family where I had an imaginary conversation with the baby and the toddler who were being horribly beaten by the mother because I needed to turn my attention to her. And I just could hardly stand the idea that that they would wonder what I was doing because I wasn't attending to them. I would dawdle with their mother. Yeah.
Yeah, but that dawdling produced some pretty amazing fruit in that story, Michael. So I think the power of holding is what first of all, the power of wondering, which is an art form, as opposed to going in and fixing, just wondering. But the holding is where the fruit arises, the hologram of what's possible in the space between you and the family. And that's what I love about listening to your stories is there's something that arises in the space, the possibility of healing and health and well-being and connection all comes out of the heart of you and your connection with those people and the manner in which you connect with presence and attunement and holding back and just wondering with a lot of presence. It's an amazing skill. And I guess I'm leaving with a desire for more more from you, Michael Trout.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be with you all for this hour. And I've saved you from the first part of the debate.
I didn't even know about that. Okay, I guess we can stop. And I want to thank you, Michael, for being here with us. And for those of you who are listening now, I will send out the recording to you. And to those who are listening in the future, I will send out the recording. So thank you for your generosity. I shall spread this word of yours, these words of yours, out into the world. So thank you again, Michael, and thank you all for coming tonight. And to be continued.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.